from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, media mogul Rupert Murdoch built News Corp from its roots in Australia to become an international multimedia empire. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik writes about the billionaire businessman in his new book, Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. And Folkenflik joins us to talk about the magnate's politics and about the trial now underway of alleged bribery and phone hacking by Murdoch's journalists in London. Forum is next. Join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The long-awaited prosecution of Rupert Murdoch's News World executives for alleged phone hacking and bribery began last week in London. Award-winning journalist and NPR's media correspondent since 2004, David Folkenflik, recently published a book about Murdoch, the Australian-born billionaire and media mogul of three separate continents and the empire he built. The book is titled Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires, and David Folkenflik joins us this morning for our opening hour. Good to have you with us. Welcome.
Hey, Michael, thanks you so much for having me.
Glad to have you. And, well, this trial is getting underway, hacking, bribery, obstruction of justice. We recently saw an article about, well, evidence being taken away by Rebecca Brooks and others. Give us a sense, if you would, just of an overview of where this is going and what's really precipitated it all.
Sure. Well, a reminder of the players involved and what's at stake. Obviously, it's thousands of miles away in Britain, but it's a major element in Rupert Murdoch's New York-based, you know, American media empire. Rebecca Brooks was a woman who used to head the News of the World, which was the largest selling Sunday tabloid in the UK. And then she went on to head the Daily Sun tabloid, which is the newspaper closest to Rupert Murdoch's heart. She was elevated by him to be CEO of his British newspaper arm and has been described by him to others as being really a surrogate daughter. She's on trial. She's on trial for conspiracy to commit hacking into the voicemail messages of people. You know, it is alleged that there were thousands of people whose phones were targeted by Murdoch's tabloid journalists and people working on their behalf, people who were celebrities, people who were politicians. And, you know, little episodes of that started to trickle out over the years, but it wasn't that outrage built until a 13-year-old girl who was murdered, abducted and murdered, turned up to be one of those whose phones were hacked. So she's on trial. Andrew Coulson, who was her colleague as editor of the News of the World and who then went on to be the chief PR guy for Prime Minister David Cameron as he sought office. And as he won it, he went into 10 Downing Street with Mr. Cameron. And in fact, it's interesting to note that the first private individual to greet David Cameron in 10 Downing Street was, in fact, Rupert Murdoch, a sign of the prestige that he held for prime ministers over the decades, but also, interestingly, a guy who was forced to enter and leave by the back door so photographers couldn't see that that arrival. So you have them and some people who acted with them, other journalists. Mrs. Brooks' husband, Charlie, is involved in charges alleging that he helped to conspire to hide evidence or destroy evidence from police. And what you're really seeing in some ways are the top lieutenants of Rupert Murdoch's newspaper world on trial, and also a very tangible sign in which the way in which the media and the political elites worked hand in glove. Rebecca Brooks and Andrew Coulson, colleagues at the Murdoch empire, and then, you know, working across institutions in some ways in very much the same direction rather than the public interest in terms of furthering their own interest when he was at 10 Downing Street and she was She was over at News Corp in the British realm.
And forgive me, we also have James Murdoch, the scion and heir apparent, or who was to be, taking over this empire that you write about in great detail. And I want to get into that as well as the political influence, talking with senior editor Dan Zoll about how maybe Tony Blair and some of these other politicians were the poodles of Rupert Murdoch rather than Bush, as has so often been alleged. But first, let's talk about things stateside with you, if we could, David. I mean, we're looking at a muzzling, essentially, of Wall Street Journal reporters on the News of the World hacking scandal. Robert Thompson, who is the managing editor, who's now chief executive, really tried a number of times to kill the story.
That's right. It was a surprise to me. I hadn't known about this until I started reporting for the book. But I want to say, you know, Rupert Murdoch took over the Wall Street Journal in 2007. He paid wildly for it. He had to write down the value of the payment. He had paid about $5.5 billion for the newspaper as a way of showing that he would be helping to control not only a popular paper like the New York Post might appeal to in a populist sense, but to elites. And so he said, "I want the Wall Street Journal. I want to own it." And it, you know, was something he had to write off by the value of by half very shortly after. He hasn't ruined the paper, as some of his critics predicted, and some of them would still maintain. You know, it's still an excellent paper with hundreds of people working there. It's a more general interest paper, less a financial paper. But at this pivotal moment in the summer of 2011, when the hacking scandal first blew up in the UK and first became, you know, really known to us here in the US on a broad level, journalists in the UK saw this as a test of their journalistic integrity, that no matter who their owner might ultimately be and who might control them, as Murdoch does, that they would still report the news without fear or favor. Well, they set out to do that, and they came out with an extraordinarily provocative and damaging story to Murdoch's interests. You know, they showed that this dead girl's phone, which had been hacked, you know, that editors for the paper had essentially conveyed that to police and had essentially said so in print in the early edition of the News of the World one Sunday. And then by the later edition, it had been scrubbed out. And this clearly showed that senior figures at the newspaper to intervene to say, hey, you can't show readers here in 2002 that we've been hacking into their voicemail messages by declaring what was on those messages. You can't say that. That shows that we've done something illegal. So pull it back. Robert Thompson tried about six different times to kill that story, prevent that from getting into print. At a pivotal moment, the top news executive handpicked by Rupert Murdoch, a guy who had overseen the Times of London for Murdoch in London, a fellow Australian, in a sense a surrogate son, much in the way Rebecca Brooks is a surrogate daughter, he decided to intervene to save his patron reputation and standing amid some real threats to their business interests in the UK. It is a credit to the Journal and its journalists that that story did appear on the front page. It was softened. The damaging information was dropped from the top paragraph to the ninth paragraph, but it still appeared in the front page. It still was understood by investigators in the UK, and it still served as the basis of one of the criminal charges that was set out in court last week in London. But, you know, Robert Thompson, at a key moment, the height of passion and of tensions, when he had to choose between a journalistic value and a protect your patron's value, he chose the idea of staying with his mate and his patron.
I guess it's also safe to say that with all the hacking that was going on of politicians and celebrities, maybe even rivaling NSA a little bit, it was the grieving family of this child, Millie Dowler, that really caused the most national revulsion and set things particularly in motion, wasn't it?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, it turned out after the revelation that her phone messages had been hacked into while police were desperately attempting to figure out where she was and what had happened to her. That set the nation on edge. You know, they felt celebrities are sort of treated as sport there. And there is an assumption among the tabloid press shared by much of their audience that most politicians are, you know, either draining some public money on the side or having affairs on the side. And they don't really seem to care if their privacy for those folks are violated. When it happened to, you know, a 13-year-old girl and a family that has never seen the limelight except in this terribly tragic and painful way, you know, they said, well, this can happen to any of us. She could be my daughter, my sister, my niece. You know, it turned out in the days that followed in rapid succession that the Brits learned that not only had her phone been hacked, but their pretty much almost anybody who had fallen in the province of the news had been hacked. You know, not just soccer players and politicians, but the families of war dead, of British troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, people who had suffered during the bombings in July 2005 and the terrorist strikes and public transit in London, if you remember those terrible bombings there. And their phones had been hacked too. And people said, well, no one is safe. This is outrageous. And to give you a sense of how widespread it was, you know, among the people who were hacked were people who had appeared in movies and TV shows that had been produced by Murdoch's media empire, politicians that his newspapers had backed, a woman whose daughter had been abducted and killed also, and who had been made into a columnist by Rebecca Brooks in the tabloids as a champion of victims' rights. Rebecca Brooks had said, here's a mobile phone. You can call me anytime you need and you can use it for anything you want. And her reporters hacked into that phone as well. Rebecca Brooks herself, when she got into a marital spat with her husband, her first husband, who was a star in a British soap opera, They hacked into her phone, too. They said they didn't really care. It was almost as though they were piranhas feeding on themselves. So the degree to which this practice occurred, you know, and obviously not all the charges that have been presented in court have been proven yet, but a number of people have already pleaded guilty to these and related charges. The degree to which this seems to have been widespread and common practice, not the, you know, isolated case, is just staggering to behold. And there was no defense. You know, Tony Blair was endorsed 3 times by the Murdoch tabloids for election, and he was very close, although a center-left politician is very close to Murdoch. He ended up being the godfather to one of Murdoch's youngest children. And yet Tony Blair's wife, Cherie, she had her phone hacked as well. Cherie Blair is currently suing News Corp. She may well have actually settled that case, but she certainly filed suit against News Corp and now its successor company, 21st Century Fox, for those claims.
If you just joined us, we're talking to NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik, who has written a new book called Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires, all about Rupert Murdoch and an empire that spans over 3 continents. And he'll be at the World Affairs Council in San Francisco on November 12th at 7 o'clock talking about this book. And this book, just in terms of doing the research, David, they wouldn't talk to you. That is, News Corp wouldn't talk to you, and they were discouraging others from talking to you. And actually, you've said publicly denigrated your reputation?
Well, you know, in a back channel way, they said, you know, this guy's, you know, not somebody we want to do business with. He's not, you know, he's not going to be on the up and up about this. You know, there was great anxiety about this. I mean, for some good reason, you've got this massive litigation happening, both civil suits in Britain and prosecution there as well of some of their former top officials. In addition, you know, they had just gone through a book at the you know, when they took over the Wall Street Journal, there were 2 books that were written. One was by Sarah Ellison, a former Wall Street Journal reporter, about the takeover of the journal. And the other was by Michael Wolff, a magazine writer, a very stylistic guy, who had convinced the Murdochs to allow him to have incredible access. And they sat down with him for hours, and they ended up revealing a lot of family tensions and dynamics that perhaps they didn't want to appear in print. Ultimately, you know, Roger Ailes was upset at a few things that were said on behalf of some of the adult children. And there are tensions there between Murdoch's children who are not as conservative as Roger Ailes, although, you know, even Rupert Murdoch is not as conservative as Roger Ailes. But there are some tensions there between the adult Murdoch children and between and Roger Ailes. But really, one of the things that was the most fraught was that Wolf was unwilling to push farther back the date at which Rupert met his third wife, Wendy Deng. Murdoch and Wendy Deng got married shortly after his divorce was finalized from his second wife, and they wanted it to make it clear that Wendy had met Murdoch well after the two of them had separated. And Wolf wasn't willing to do that. There clearly was some overlap between the relationships there. And so since then, they have been much more cautious and wary of coverage. They did, you know, I had a senior executive at News Corp essentially cancel within 24 hours of when we were supposed to sit down. It had taken a long time to orchestrate. And one of his aides said, you know, we got a call from one of Rupert's top people and they're not allowing this to happen. Similarly, when I went to talk to people at Fox for the book explicitly, you know, from on high on down, they said, you know, the Murdochs don't want this to happen, so it's not going to happen. On the plus side, I've been covering media for 13 years, since 2004 for NPR, as you noted. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of people over the years. I have a lot of relevant interviews that I've done. And I know a lot of people, so I've gone back to people time and again. And I got to say I'm appreciative to so many people at News Corp, now at 21st Century Fox. It's a sort of sister corporation where Fox News is now found. And talk to them again and again, and they've patiently taken the time to make sure I understood the context and facts of certain events, way things happened, that I think allow me to put it in a pretty textured light. It just, you know, puts additional burden on me to go not only the extra mile, but an extra miles and miles to make sure I'm being fair and fully understand the context in which things occurred.
Well, you've gone many miles in this book, and I hope we can talk about some of those miles that you've traveled, particularly with respect to Roger Ailes and Fox, and a lot of attention, a lot of focus is paid to the political shop, the public relations shop at Fox, and the way things actually, I think you mentioned Michael Wolff, I think he called it a blood sport. CNN got set up by Fox, one of their reporters, actually one of their writers, Matthew Flam. There were dummy accounts to essentially follow blog posts. And there's also kind of what you describe as, well, I don't know if this is your words, but culture of cruelty.
No, that's actually a phrase that I use to describe it. There's a look. Fox is interesting because it's more autonomous than almost any of the, say, the newspapers from Murdoch. And it's autonomous for two reasons. One, Roger Ailes has a very clear vision of what he wants to do. And secondly, they make a ton of money for Murdoch and for the company. And therefore, you know, that wins you some latitude. Ailes is more conservative than Murdoch. You know, there was until about last year a pretty strong fairly strong concern, anxiety, hostility at times toward the idea of a greater immigration amnesty and reforms like that. Murdoch is an immigrant himself and has been proposing certain kinds of reforms publicly. But, you know, he gives them their lead. At the same time, there's some common DNA there.
Excuse me, David. I just have to interrupt here because I was surprised to learn. I mean, you give a nuanced portrait of Murdoch, including not only his favoring immigration reform, but education reform and concern about global warming, even after there was a long attempt to deny any kind of global warming or climate change. He's more complicated than I suppose most people realize.
He is, you know. I mean, in terms of global warming, well, you know, he's in favor of certain kinds of corporate action against greater regulations and taxation to achieve it. But yes, he acknowledges it in a way that a lot of his highest paid performers on Fox News tend to cast doubt or even deny. So, you know, there's a dissonance there.
Isn't News Corp now carbon neutral, in fact?
News Corp is not only carbon neutral, it had a 5-year timeline by which to achieve that, and it beat that timeline. That was a goal that was obtained by Murdoch or set by Murdoch at the urging of his son and of his James Murdoch and James's wife, who's an environmental activist and is you know interested and active in those issues. He went to Pebble Beach at an event where Tony Blair was there, then Governor Schwarzenegger of California was there, and Al Gore presented his film *An Inconvenient Truth* and talked about those issues with them. And Murdoch said, you know, there's such extreme weather patterns occurring in my native Australia, we have to think about these things pretty carefully. So, you know, he did that. And for a brief time, his news organizations did a flurry of stories to sort of show concern, even in the New York Post, which has cast doubt over the years, and Sky News. And, you know, Fox did a little bit of a look at global warming in an even-handed way, an extended piece at one point, 2006, early 2007, I believe. And so all these guys were kind of getting on board and trying to think about these things. And yet, if you look at his tabloids in Australia in particular, but, you know, throughout the other countries as well, you know, you see unbelievable degree of casting doubt on what seems to be a fairly strong scientific consensus. And, you know, he didn't have to address things in the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal because it outflanks him on the right like Fox does. It's more conservative than he is, and they have long been hostile to the idea of global warming consensus.
Well, you mentioned Australia. I mean, I was surprised to hear that he did a whole piece on Aborigines early on in his career, that he actually subsidized the Times of London and the Times Literary Supplement. I'm not trying to make him into any kind of heroic figure here or icon because he's a complicated figure and there's a lot of dark sides to Rupert Murdoch. But you do give a pretty balanced and nuanced portrait. But let me get you back to Fox News here because, you know, to a great extent, you probably know that Farley Dickinson University study found that people who watch no news at all can answer more questions about international current events than people who watch cable news. And I'm reading from that study, quote, "The largest effect is that of Fox News. All else being equal, someone who watched only Fox News would be expected to answer just 1.04 domestic questions correctly, a figure which is significantly worse than if they had reported watching no media at all." And that's Roger Ailes' shop, admittedly, but the PR shop really gets kind of front billing here in your book. I want to find out what you make of that study and what you make of essentially the way they go after in this culture of cruelty anybody who seems to be in opposition to them.
Well, so in terms of the study, you know, I've seen studies saying some conflicting things where you can watch Fox News and find people have a general sense of certain issues, but they may have a misimpression of the implications of some of those issues. But, you know, I've seen certain conflicting reports on that. Let me say this about the way Fox approaches things, though, that is very consistent with Murdoch's outlook. It is a news organization that is wrapped around it a political sensibility. On the one hand, there's an ideological sensibility of being fairly consistently conservative, but there's also a political sensibility that you're picking themes of the day, threads and storylines of the day. And from your news shows to your opinion shows, those threads are going to be pretty consistent and pretty common. common. You identify not only people that you support, but people that you oppose and criticize. But those aren't just people that you oppose. Those are people who are identified as enemies, you know, whose position are castigated. So, and that doesn't even just occur in the political realm. That occurs in the professional realm. So CNN, at least on the air, and the New York Times and, you know, NPR and other places that you might see as peers or as competitors from news organization to news organizations, are instead seen as opponents and enemies and are targeted in that way. Well, in some ways, the purest form of how Roger Ailes really thinks is reflected on the air on Fox and Friends, which is sort of a breezy, happy-go-lucky show that, you know, actually has a pretty tough and bruising face to it when you really look at the content of what they're saying. Off the air, the PR shop is a pure extension of how he operates. So there were a number of cases. You mentioned Matthew Flam. He actually works for Crain's Business New York, a trade publication here in Manhattan. And he was among a couple of reporters in the fall, in the spring of 2008 during the Democratic primaries, who noticed CNN was doing really well in the ratings. And Fox has been dominant in cable ratings for a long time. So the point at which CNN or MSNBC suddenly has a significant uptick is that's what we call news. It's a development. So Tim Marengo, the New York Times, was covering media. You know, he explored this. And suddenly, when he did a story on this, very much to the opposition of Fox News PR shop, a top official at Fox PR said, "You should really be careful about doing this. You have no idea what they can do to you." And he says, "That sounds ominous." And she says, "You know, you've been warned." And so he publishes a story. It's a modest story. CNN gets ratings gains. And then you have gossip blogs in New York that are filled with postings that say, "Has Tim Marengo just been treated for substance abuse?" And it turned out actually he had. But this secret, which had no bearing, this private matter, which had no bearing on his reporting whatsoever, suddenly became public by virtue of Fox saying, "If you're going to go in a direction we don't want you to do, even on a minor story, we will punish you for it. And that means you're going to think again, but also other reporters are going to take that as a lesson. Don't mess with us." Matthew Flam, you mentioned, who's with Crain's Business New York trade publication, he was doing a similar story about a similar scenario that very fall, spring. You know, Obama and Hillary Clinton were having a tremendous primary slugfest. It's good, you know, it's meat for ratings for cable news. CNN did well. He pursued it as well, gets comments from CNN, comments from MSNBC. Fox doesn't even like being mentioned in the same article as those guys because it thinks it's so far beyond them. To Flam, they didn't respond at all. But Flam got an email from a Hotmail account of a senior producer on the O'Reilly show, the O'Reilly Factor. And she said, "You know, Matt, you're absolutely right. They are panicking about ratings here at Fox. And I can tell you they're going to scrap the anchors leading the coverage at the convention this summer, and they're going to have Bill O'Reilly do it." And that would have marked the first time that an opinion host for Fox, you know, whatever you think about the way in which opinion bleeds into their news shows, they do try to have anchors host major moments and events rather than their opinion hosts. They say, "We're going to try to do this just like Keith Olbermann has done it for MSNBC. So he tries to get a second source. He emails and back and forth with her. He says to his editors, "I've got one source." They say, "Just put it online. Don't put it in print." He posts it. And that's what we call in journalism a pretty big mistake, because by posting that, he gave them an opening, and they battered him in the blogs just within, you know, 90 minutes. By name, public relations officials for Fox News said, "This guy can't be trusted. He can't be believed. This is completely wrong. We would never do something like that. Our news anchors are hosting this. Bill O'Reilly would never do it." So Matthew Flam calls his source, and he calls her in the newsroom and says, "What the heck happened there? What? How was I wrong?" And she said, "I don't know who you are. The mail account was fake. It had been set up by PR accounts executives for Fox News as a way of destroying his reputation."
This is right out of House of Cards, I got to say. And I also have to give out the phone number because we're talking to David Folkenflik. And you may want to join us talking about Rupert Murdoch, about Fox News, the Wall Street Journal here on Stateside, the trial that's going on. Your thoughts are welcome, and so are your questions and comments. Toll free, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with David Folkenflik, who is NPR's media correspondent. He also worked for the Baltimore Sun, award-winning journalist who has been with NPR since 2004, and we'll be at the World Affairs Council on November 12th at 7 p.m. in San Francisco, and talking to him about the trial that got underway, that is essentially a trial of bribery and hacking and obstruction of justice and
all that. Rebecca Brooks, the surrogate daughter, as she's so often described, as David said, of Rupert Murdoch, and also Murdoch and the Murdoch Empire, the major, most major figure certainly in journalism and major media mogul since William Randolph Hearst. And you may want to bring in your own questions and comments here or simply join the conversation. Our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls and emails. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, and other ways to communicate with us, including, of course, our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. I want to go to your calls and emails just forthwith here, but David, let me just get back before the break. And how'd you track all this down? I mean, especially about the way the PR shop operated.
Well, that story, took a lot of emails, a lot of phone calls, a lot of conversations. There were people who were nervous about it. You know, I spoke to a lot of people inside Fox and a lot of people who had, you know, had.
Well, wait, let me be more specific. How'd you find that email actually came from Fox?
I confirmed that story with, I believe, four people, at least four people. I talked to at least three people who are knowledgeable about that situation from Flam's standpoint. And once I was able to kind of run that to ground, I was able to confirm that with somebody who was at Fox News at the time of the incident with contemporaneous knowledge of it, that is, knowledge of it at the moment it was happening. I felt that it was a pretty unbelievable thing to see. You know, I also –
Woodward and Bernstein used to say you only need three to confirm, remember? You got four.
Well, I wanted very much to have somebody inside Fox News because I wanted to have comfort level with that. Among the things that I found out about first and that you alluded to in passing was they used to do these crazy things where they would make their PR staffers get – one of them had 20 aliases. Another had over 100 aliases, and they had to go on the blogs, rebut every negative or even neutral – blog posting about a Fox coverage or Fox News journalists and opinion hosts and commentators and sort of then get involved not only with the postings themselves but with the commentators. One person described to me being berated at 2 or 3 in the morning for having failed to rebut a comment deep down in the comments on a blog that had maybe a few hundred or a few thousand readers. The idea that the audience for that commentary back and forth would have more than a few eyeballs is extremely unlikely, but they would go to these extraordinary depths. They would make staffers buy on their own dime these little thumbnail drive wireless access cards so that they couldn't be traced back to News Corp. They would make them use rehabilitated laptops that didn't have any connection to News Corp or Fox News. One guy was required to use AOL dial-up, even in the age of broadband, because they thought that might camouflage the internet protocol address so that if anybody tried to trace back who was doing these postings, it wouldn't get back to Fox. This is essentially a political shop that happens to be appended to an organization that has news in its name.
Well, let's just for a moment, I want to bring our listeners in this, but talk about the organization itself, because when Juan Williams was fired, they took an attack on NPR that was probably unprecedented in terms of wanting to see NPR defunded. And that certainly had all the earmarks of a political crusade.
Well, Roger Ailes decided at the very highest levels when NPR terminated Juan Williams' contract, and whatever you think the merits of that, you know, that's usually the occasion for news articles, for perhaps some criticism, and people move on. You know, newspapers, you know, decide to part ways with columnists all the time. When William Kristol was a columnist for the New York Times, and he was editor of the conservative Weekly Standard. You know, they parted ways. That occasioned some columns. That didn't occasion a mass movement against the New York Times. Well, in this instance, it did, and that's because Juan had felt genuinely aggrieved. He felt that his character had been assailed in the instance for which his contract was terminated. But he also had a platform on which to rebut it. And they decided to use that as an opportunity, because Juan is a commentator on Fox News. In fact, that's where the controversial comments that he made ensued or took place. They took it as a campaign. So not only was it covered, and I talked earlier about the idea of these common threads and storylines that happen in show after show and with host after host, but they decided to make that, to use NPR as a pinata. It was very successful. It whipped up a ton of concern. We had, as I'm sure you were, we were flooded with complaints. Many of them had not actually seen what Juan had said or had actually listen to NPR shows because they said, you know, we watch NPR all the time. And you think, well, that's probably somebody who's a viewer rather than a listener to NPR, but that's okay. But they used this as a political campaign, and it dovetailed perfectly with the Republicans' drive to take over both houses of Congress. They were obviously, as you know, successful with the House of Representatives, but all this occurred in the three-week period leading up to the November 2010 elections.
We're going to bring our listeners into this, and you may want to comment again not only on the Murdoch empire, which includes Fox News and the Wall Street Journal, as well as the New York Post, and the kind of journalism, put that in quotes in some instances, that's been associated with Rupert Murdoch, but also Rupert Murdoch himself, because David goes through a whole portrait of Murdoch in his book, David Folkenflik, who's with us this hour, NPR's media correspondent. And you get a guy who sort of in some ways, I mean, he came from a fairly wealthy family. In fact, he's a papal knight, Sir Keith Murdoch. His father was a pretty influential and successful mogul in his own right. But what you get is a portrait of somebody who reminds me, I must say, of Richard Nixon a bit and the way he felt about the Kennedys. You know, Murdoch wanted to fancy himself, or continues to fancy himself perhaps, as a outsider and a victim against the BBC and the New York Times, the way Nixon did against the Kennedys and the northeastern elite of the United States. But let me get your calls on here. And let me go first to you, Robert. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I'm wondering whether you found any evidence in your research that this culture of cruelty, or you might call it a culture of attack, was directed as much at Murdoch's allies, supposed political allies, as his enemies. I remember reading something that a Republican strategist has said, you know, they thought they controlled Fox News and found out that Fox News controlled them.
Well, I think that, you know, if you look at Fox News now, you know, Roger Ailes effectively has given notice. You know, they're no longer the smoke-filled rooms where people decide who the nominee is going to be. And he will either end up on his shows, you know, allowing you to see who a favored candidate will be. Or in the case of 2012, you know, he said, look, I'm not a big fan of any of these guys. So we'll be the arbiter and the umpire of who gets to emerge from this primary season. You saw Mitt Romney in late 2011, as the primary season was starting to kick off, you know, avoid doing national interviews, even when the New York Times was doing a big profile of him, or Time Magazine alike. But he ultimately had to sit down time and again with folks at Fox, even though he wasn't always comfortable with it. Brett Baier did some tough interviewing, I think, to Brett's credit. But also it was part not only of a journalistic effort, but an effort to show that the Republic, you know, you could go anywhere to find about President Obama and certain issues if there were a Democratic primary there, but you couldn't go anywhere else other than Fox to see the candidates playing out in that realm. I do think that if you're looking sort of broader than Fox, there are times where Murdoch's press will turn on people that they've favored. Sometimes they'll do it and nip at their heels a little bit to remind them that they have to pay attention. And sometimes they'll do it with great vigor. So you're seeing right now the Murdoch press turn on David Cameron to a degree in Britain, because Cameron has been sympathetic to some calls by some of the hacking victims for greater regulation of the press. And I must say, it's regulations that we would never accept as journalists here in the U.S. But in that culture, that there is some sense that there may be a push toward that. And Cameron at least has made sympathetic noises. You've seen them beat up Cameron for that and for some other things, I think, basically because of their antipathy toward that drive. In Australia, I think it's the best example. You know, Murdoch has gained a great deal of influence, not by being a rigid Republican or conservative, but by, although clearly being conservative and of the political right, by allowing his papers to move between the sort of center left and the significant right. And that gives politicians of both major parties in all three of these countries, Australia, the US, and the UK, hope that they may get the Murdoch support. And Murdoch support in past decades was seen as vital by politicians. And currently, it's not clear if they carry the same weight, but it's clear that politicians fear that they might. So Kevin Rudd, a centrist candidate from the Labour Party in 2007, had Murdoch's tabloids blessings. He said it was time for a new face and a new force in Australia, and this is a centrist enough figure, we can do business with him. He ran for re-election this past year. Murdoch sent down Col Allen, the editor-in-chief of the New York Post, and an Australian who used to be editor of the largest paper in Sydney, Australia. He sent him down there to oversee all of his newspaper's coverage. And it's worth pointing out that Murdoch controls between 65 and 70% of daily major newspapers circulation in Australia. So that's a huge deal. And Carl Allen ensured that on a daily basis they pummeled Kevin Rudd. They thought he was too interested in regulation of broadband access and of for allowing public subsidy for it for a way that might divert money from some of Murdoch's ventures down there. They thought that he's too much a champion of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which is like the BBC down there. And they thought he was too in favor of taxation and regulation on a variety of issues, including carbon emissions, and they hammered him. So that was a guy they supported. They criticized him for a while, and then they hammered him, and he went down. And even if Tony Abbott, the new prime minister, a conservative, had not needed Murdoch's help at all, he thinks he needed Murdoch's help, and that gives him great influence there.
And let me thank Robert for the call. And by the way, you're free to join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Let's bring another caller in, and that's Colin, good morning.
Your guest describes Rebecca Brooks and Andrew Coulson as colleagues, but isn't it true that they've been having an extramarital affair? I find it a little ironic that they would have such a lack of respect for the privacy of the subjects they were reporting on in that context. Secondly, shouldn't the U.S. Justice Department pursue a criminal prosecution of News Corp for violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, namely paying bribes to police officers in order to hack phones?
So, Colin, these are actually great points. Rebecca Brooks and Andrew Coulson had an affair that, according to evidence presented by prosecutors in court last week in London, that lasted 6 years.
They've got those emails, a lot of them, don't they? In fact,
what was a very poignant kind of love letter from her at a point at which it appeared that Andrew Coulson was intending to break things off. They were both married, at least for a significant stretch of that time. There hasn't been evidence presented that that affair was going on while Coulson was working in Downing Street for the prime minister. But certainly they were best friends. They were close colleagues. They worked together on a daily basis. And, you know, Colin's absolutely right. You know, at the time of the poignance of this private love affair that was, happening to two married people, they were, sending reporters, at least according to evidence presented by prosecutors, to invade the privacy of untold numbers of people who were engaged in similar conduct. And it was from their thinking, their affair was this difficult, problematic thing that they cared about very much. And for other people, it was just grist for the tabloids. As to the second point, it's absolutely true under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that it is illegal for an American corporation or its officials or employees to bribe public officials abroad. And one of the interesting elements of that, there's no dollar figure attached to that. A $100 bribe, a $1,000 bribe, a $100,000 bribe doesn't really matter. In this case, a lot of the bribes seem to be in the order of the low thousands. But the feds are, I think, watching very closely from what I've been told from legal sources to what's happening in the UK. Because News Corp cooperated at least for a significant while, that earned some good graces with feds here. And because the British are prosecuting this stuff with such vigor at the moment, the feds don't feel that they have to act instantly. They want to see the outcome of this and then see if there are things they need to follow up. There are additional things. News Corp could be charged corporately in the UK. And that would be very significant for Murdoch now. There could be it seems more likely there would be a significant civil fine in this company rather than a country rather than a prosecution. But, all of that's up in the air, and some of that will depend on what evidence is found. I know also that certain senators on the Democratic side have taken great interest in this and have sought additional evidence as well. So it's not over in terms of what the implications could be in this country.
Although it's getting tremendous media coverage, obviously, in the UK compared to here. And I wanted to ask you, how much do you think Murdoch actually knew about the hacking? Do we know or can we even surmise or guess what he knew?
Well, let me say a couple things about that. First off, it turns out there is no greater gossip on earth than Rupert Murdoch himself. I talked with one editor-in-chief, a guy who used to be the editor and then the publisher of the New York Post, and he said, in the days before email and before caller ID, every tabloid editor had two phones on their desk, and one was for all of your calls, and the other only Rupert Murdoch had. And you knew that if that phone called, you picked it up. And he would take advantage of the hours of the day. When it was morning in New York, he would call New York and say, Murdoch here, what do you know? When it was morning in London, he'd call London and say, Murdoch here, what do you got? When it was morning in Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane and other cities there, he would call them and say that too. And the sun really never set on the Murdoch empire. He could just use the hours of the day to find out what the gossip was, and he loved it. He may not have said, well, how do you know that? That's not really usually the kind of journalism he did. He'd say, that's the details. You figure it out. You tell me what you've learned. But, you know, is it possible he knew? It's possible. At the moment, I've seen no evidence to suggest he knew that hacking was taking place.
But it seems likely at this point that his son knew, doesn't it?
Well, look, you know, you mentioned James Murdoch earlier, and I think it's important to note that James Murdoch is not facing any charges. And he has been held by Parliament to have given significantly misleading evidence, and they've sort of denounced him. Parliament, in fact, in an official review, and it was a split vote but a majority vote of the parliamentary committee that did this, found that the Murdochs were not fit to proprietors. Of BSkyB, the largest private broadcaster in the UK, which they control and have a 40% stake in. So, you know, James's credibility has come into doubt. There was a time – the pivotal moment came when his top lieutenants came to him and said, we need to buy this guy off. He's the top official in the Professional Soccer Players Association. We hacked into his phone too. It's as bad as we feared, and it's only going to get worse. And he said, yeah, sure. He says he didn't really read on his BlackBerry down the full way on all the back and forth emails that were forwarded to him, that he just sort of took the top line of the email and talked to his guys for a few minutes and gave them approval to go spend far more money than had ever been spent on a settlement like that. The key element that I think a lot of critics of James Murdoch have pointed to was that not only was the amount of the settlement confidential, but the fact of a settlement was confidential, that they paid a premium to make sure that not only would this never get to court where they might have to pay more, but there would never be word of this in public. And so Murdoch, is not criminally accused of participating in a cover-up as a result of that. But a lot of his journalists say, hey, he was involved in this too as a result.
I'd like to read some listener emails, and just let me read some opinions here and then to some questions for you, David. One of our listeners, Phyllis, writes, with all the dumping on Fox News from your guests, it is worth noting that surveys show that, yes, the public thinks Fox has a conservative bias. Surveys also show that by the same margin, the public thinks NPR, PBS, CBS, and CNN and the other networks have a liberal bias. Want to respond to that, David?
Sure. You know, look, I think that Fox News, was founded because Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes rightly saw that there would be an audience for news that came at things from a different perspective, that for particularly people who felt that coastal elites, especially coastal urban, residents, you know, were being served by the mainstream media, but that people, other folks, weren't. And so, you know, if you take an issue like gay rights that many Americans now feel, and that particularly, you know, many people who live in cities now feel, can be looked at through the prism of the civil rights movement for African Americans. A lot of journalists have covered it that way. If you look at coverage in the New York Times, it's hard to look at it any other way. And yet, you know, Fox News can say, well, that those voices should be reflected in our coverage, but maybe we'll reflect the views of people who feel that this is actually a moment at which an institution that they cherish is coming under challenge and that the fabric of that is being pulled at and distorted a bit. And we may not feel that way about it 30 years from now, but this is a part of the population that really feels this, and they're being presented somehow as though they're bigots, and not all of them are. In fact, many of them are not, and that this is just how they look at this. And for Fox News, that's an opportunity to define maybe a same story, but from a different looking through a different end of the telescope. And they not only pursued those stories with a vigor, and I think there's room for a lot of different voices in journalism. I absolutely it's good for Fox to be there. But they not only pursued stories like that, they also pursued stories that said to the public, by the way, so you know you're being lied to by the rest of the press, or you're being deceived by the rest of the press being a biased. And that is, you know, their repetition of that on a nearly daily basis has made that commonly accepted. You know, I'm pretty agnostic on this stuff. I think, you know, you ultimately are as your audience perceives you to be to a degree. But, you know, when I see journalists getting out of bed in the morning, people who work for The New York Times or NPR or CBS or other places, almost none of them get out of bed to try to think, hey, how can I help a partisan cause? How can I help somebody else's belief system? Most of them are saying, you know, what are the most interesting stories and how can I figure out what's the truth behind them?
Or in commercial broadcasting.
Different animating things.
In commercial broadcasting, how can I get better ratings or get the exclusive of the story?
Absolutely.
Let me just read a few of these emails. David writes, Murdoch is a perfect archetype of the modern evil genius. He's also a great example of why large, consolidated media ownership can gravely damage a democracy. Our politicians are helped by this machine, so it won't ever be fixed. Kurt writes, what passes for news today is more like propaganda. There are so many facts that are omitted, and the stories are all spun to a particular point of view. And Max writes, the amazing disappearing act, formerly known as cable news, I can't recall when was the last honest news story on CNN or Fox. CNN seems to believe dog and pony shows are actually news, and Fox's, well, do I need to say it? Let me get your response, David, to a couple of other emails here. This one comes from Steve, who says, in the book Dial M for Murdoch by Martin Hickman and Tom Watson, they point out that it took lawyers, politicians, and journalists who weren't controlled by Murdoch to uncover the level of corruption in the UK. They stopped News Corp from buying BSkyB, a profitable TV channel. Has the scandal cost News Corp, a U.S.-based corporation, anything in the United States? And what kind of impact, if any, has it had on Fox?
You know, look, I don't think it's had an impact on Fox. I think there was a worry that the scandal would bleed over here. So far, it's been largely contained. It has cost the company hundreds of millions of dollars. The former CEO of News International, Tom Mockridge, estimated it could cost over $1.6 billion ultimately. It forced Rupert Murdoch to do something he said he would never do, which is split the company in two. You know, he loves these newspapers because he loves newspapers, but he also loves them because they give him influence that at key moments becomes power, as it did in Britain, as he was poised to take over 100% of BSkyB. As I mentioned, he has about 40, you know, his companies have about 40% of it now. So he's had to suffer a lot of things. The reason why that split is important is that, you know, the New York Post, which has never made him a dollar, the Times of London, which has never made him a dollar, you know, and if you think about all these Australian papers, which are quite dominant, but whose revenues are starting to plummet, their fortunes were protected by the massive profits of Fox News and BSkyB and some of the Fox studios on years where they have movies like Avatar and FX and other properties. Those very profitable properties are now split off into 21st Century Fox. So those profits can no longer subsidize the struggling fortunes of the newspaper.
And forgive me, Rupert Murdoch is still the chair and CEO of 21st Century Fox.
He is. The funny thing is he's not even CEO of the new News Corp, which are his newspapers and his publishing house and some other properties in Australia. You know, he's nominally not the CEO of that. The former top editor at the Wall Street Journal, Robert Thompson, is now the CEO of that. But that's actually what he really spends his time on and really cares about are the newspapers. But, you know, he's trying to figure out a way to keep the New York Post open. It's lost, estimates vary, but call it 80, call it $100 million a year. And it's been worth it to him to have this noisy place at the table where he can sound off on politics and make people pay attention. But, you know, you can't do that forever. And, you know, then again, he's in his early 80s. He may not live forever. One of the funny things I learned around News Corp in doing this book is people don't say, well, when Rupert steps aside or when Rupert dies. They say, if Rupert steps aside.
Well, he's got a mother who's 102, right?
He thinks she died last December,
yeah,
but she lived
she lived
a very long time.
So he thinks he's going to be a centenarian. Let me go to another email here. This is from Joseph. And if you've just joined us, we're talking to National Public Radio's David Folkenflik, who is the author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires, and he'll be appearing in San Francisco at the World Affairs Council November 12th at 7 p.m. Joseph writes, I lived in the U.K. for over 10 years, and Murdoch's apologists, often but not always, in the Tory Conservative Party and or enemies of the BBC often said that Murdoch didn't dictate the news or the headlines, and quite possibly that was true in a literal sense. He didn't necessarily tell his editors what to print. But Tony Blair, according to memoirs of his aides, felt the need to check with Murdoch before announcing policy on the European Union. Over the course of the decade, the U.K. and U.S. fought the war in Iraq, for which Murdoch's papers were beating the drum. The U.K. moved further and further away from the European Union, and the UK government approved Murdoch's taking full control of Sky News in the UK, and the BBC's license fee was cut. It seems like whatever the mechanisms, Murdoch got what he wanted, and that was in no small part because British politicians feared him. How does the reality match that perception, and how has it changed in light of the hacking scandal?
This is an excellent question, and your listeners' experiences are pretty much dead on. Tony Blair, as a center-left politician, he showed Murdoch that he would be very attentive to him when he was in opposition, 1995, gearing up for a run 2 years later for prime minister. He flew halfway across the globe to Hayman's Island off the coast of Australia to meet with Murdoch. And at that meeting, I'm told, you know, he didn't make any firm promises about what he would do to help Murdoch or how he might hurt the BBC or anything like that. But the fact of flying there showed him they could do business. Murdoch swung his support from the Conservatives, who were a spent force under John Major, and switched over to the new Labour of Tony Blair in the center left. And Blair didn't switch out. He supported the euro, the common currency. He didn't drop his support, but he agreed when Murdoch made clear how vehemently opposed it to hold a referendum on joining the euro. Well, that was something that Blair was going to have a very hard time winning. And, you know, it showed Murdoch that he might not reverse himself, but that he would bend to Murdoch's will on political matters. And on certain kinds of commercial matters, he made it very easy for Murdoch to sidestep certain kinds of scrutiny and regulatory review that might have been quite problematic and complicated. So, you know, even as everyone rushed toward him, Prime Minister David Cameron flew to the Greek Isle of Santorini on Murdoch's son-in-law's jet to meet with him on a yacht off the coast of the island to indicate similarly while he was gearing up for his run, you know, I will defer to you, sir. You know, they could have met Murdoch in London at one of their social clubs or even at one of Murdoch's residences. This is a way of going the extra, you know, continent, I suppose, to show that you're willing to show deference. In this country, you know, Murdoch has been able to exercise a lot of political influence. But, you know, the New York Post, it looked like in the early 90s, 20 years ago, was going to close after a couple of its proprietors couldn't afford to keep it open. Politicians of both party hailed him as a, you know, in return for a second round as ownership of the New York Post, helping them sweep aside regulatory concerns to do that. That both benefited Murdoch and, in a sense, you know, it kept another voice, another newspaper alive. So, you know, he has gotten politicians on both sides in all three of these countries to give him support and often, not always, often what he wanted, but they know they can't sidestep him until this scandal. And in the last 2+ years, you know, in Britain, politicians have run away from him. In this country, you know, Murdoch is a champion of education reform, which is supported by some center left and certainly a lot of conservative voices. You know, I've seen him on panels with major, you know, Silicon Valley types. I've seen him, you know, talking with Michael Bloomberg about the need for school reform. So there isn't the same distancing occurring here. If you think about the reporting model for Fox News, it's really a much leaner operation than CNN. They don't need the scoops in that way. They need the heat and the intense exchanges on their political and opinion shows.
I'm sorry to say we're flat out of time, but certainly has been enlightening. And David Folkenflik, let me thank you for being with us this hour. Much appreciated. David Folkenflik is media correspondent for National Public Radio, author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. He'll be at the World Affairs Council of Northern California November 12th at 7 p.m. Good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks so much, Michael.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Another hour of Forum coming up. We're going to talk in the hour ahead with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Finkel, who has written a book, well, all about the after war, what happens when soldiers come back. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.